From Pacifica, this is Democracy Now!
The Gaza disengagement is a giant propaganda effort designed to convince us that the Middle East is moving towards peace. It may simply mark the beginning of a new and much bloodier phase in this long-running conflict.
Today, the Israeli pullout from the Gaza Strip begins. We'll go to Gaza, and then a peace accord is signed between the Indonesian government and the Achenese rebels, a deal that disarms one side, leaving the Indonesian military in place.
There has been no peace in Aceh because there has been no justice in Aceh. What we hope we have achieved with the signing of this peace agreement is the beginning of a process that will bring justice to the people of Aceh.
All that and more coming up. Welcome to Democracy Now!, democracynow.org, The War and Peace Report. I'm Amy Goodman. The Israeli army has begun handing eviction notices to Jewish settlers in Gaza, marking the start of Israel's withdrawal from the Palestinian territories. Gaza's 9,000 settlers now have until Wednesday to vacate their homes. The army's already sealed off the Gaza Strip, and Israeli citizens have been barred from entering any settlements slated for evacuation. Israel's threatened to forcibly remove any remaining settlers beginning on Wednesday, but thousands of residents have vowed to resist their eviction. Settlers have already begun blocking access to the settlements by IDF troops. Meanwhile, Palestinians have begun holding celebrations to mark Israel's withdrawal. Palestinian leader Mahmoud Abbas hailed the move as historic, but said Israel should also pull out of the West Bank. We'll have more on the Gaza withdrawal in a few minutes. We'll be speaking with a settler in Gaza as well as a Palestinian human rights activist. The Indonesian government and Achenese rebels, known as the GAM, have signed a deal ending a three-decade struggle for Achenese independence. Under the agreement, the rebels will disarm, be allowed to form a local political party. Rebels will also be given amnesty, money, and farmland in order to ease the transition into civilian life. Indonesia, in turn, will withdraw some of its troops from Aceh, but Indonesia is reserving the right to return troops to the region. The government has also agreed to release some Achenese political prisoners. Over the past decade, the Indonesian military has killed thousands of Achenese civilians. We'll go to the region later in the program to get the latest. In Crawford, Texas, Cindy Sheehan has begun day 9 of her vigil outside President Bush's vacation ranch. Sheehan has vowed to remain in Crawford until the president meets with her. Last year, Sheehan's oldest son, Casey, died in Iraq. He was 24 years old. Hundreds of anti-war activists have now joined Sheehan in protests that has received international attention. This is Cindy Sheehan.
This is really hard. Not only am I, like, trying to stop the war, but I have to grieve my son every day. Every day I wake up, it's like April 4th all over again. I have to realize I have to go for another day without my son, and it's really, really hard. And then I do this on top of it.
On Saturday, President Bush defended his decision not to meet with Sheehan. He said, quote, "I think it's important for me to be thoughtful and sensitive to those who have got something to say, but I think it's also important for me to go on with my life." Bush's comments came before he went on a two-hour bike ride with journalists and aides. In addition, Bush spent Saturday attending a Little League baseball game, having lunch with Secretary of State Condoleezza Rice, napping, fishing, and reading. On Friday, Bush attended a political fundraiser. Tensions are also rising in Crawford. One local farmer fired a gun on his property near the protest site. When asked if he was trying to send a message, the farmer said, quote, "Figure it out for yourself." Meanwhile, the Washington Post is reporting the Bush administration is significantly lowering expectations of what can be achieved in Iraq. Officials are now saying the U.S. can no longer expect to see a model new democracy, a self-supporting oil industry, or a society in which the majority of people are free from serious security or economic challenges. This comes as negotiations on a new Iraqi constitution remain deadlocked. Today is the deadline for the National Assembly to draft a constitution. The New York Times reports Shia leaders are considering asking the National Assembly to approve the constitution without the agreement of the country's Sunni leaders. Iraq's Sunni leadership has criticized a Shiite proposal to create an autonomous Shiite region in the oil-rich southern portion of Iraq. Negotiations are also ongoing over the role of Islam in the state and the role and the rights of women. And the Washington Post reports that U.S. Ambassador Zalmay Khalilzad attempted to break the deadlock by presenting a U.S.-backed draft of the Iraqi constitution. One Kurdish legislator described the U.S. draft as a, quote, almost full version of a constitution. He said, quote, the U.S. officials are more interested in the Iraqi constitution than the Iraqis themselves. This news on Iran. President Bush is warning that, quote, all options are on the table if Iran refuses to comply with international demands to halt their nuclear program. President Bush's comment came during an interview on Israeli television.
Look, in all these instances, we want diplomacy to work. And so we're working feverishly on the diplomatic route. And, you know, we'll see if we're successful or not. I'm skeptical.
If not?
Well, that's all options are on the table.
Including use of force?
Well, you know, as I say, all options are on the table. The use of force is the last option for any president. Mm-hmm. And, you know, we've used force in the recent past to secure our country. It is it's difficult for the commander-in-chief to put kids in harm's way. Nevertheless, I have been willing to do so as last resort in order to secure the country and to provide the opportunity for people to live in free societies.
President Bush's warning was criticized by German Chancellor Gerhard Schroeder. He said, quote, let's take the military option off the table. We've seen it doesn't work. Now on to the latest in the investigation into who within the Bush administration outed CIA operative Valerie Plame, the wife of Ambassador Joseph Wilson. Congressmember John Conyers is calling for an investigation into former Attorney General John Ashcroft's role in the case. Ashcroft initially refused to recuse himself from the investigation despite his longtime association with Karl Rove, who was being questioned over the leak by the FBI. At the time, Ashcroft was being personally briefed about the investigation. Conyers described this as a, quote, stunning ethical breach that cries out for an immediate investigation. Conyers' call comes after a new report by investigative journalist Murray Wass that Justice Department officials decided to appoint a special prosecutor in large part because investigators had begun to specifically question the veracity of accounts provided to them by Karl Rove. When first questioned by the FBI, Rove failed to tell FBI investigators that he talked to Time reporter Matthew Cooper about Wilson's wife. In addition, Rove claims he learned of Valerie Plame's identity during a conversation with a journalist. But according to Wass, Rove was unable to recall virtually anything to investigators about the circumstances about that conversation, including who the journalist was or whether it took part in person or on the phone. In Mississippi, a former Ku Klux Klansman has been released on bail less than 2 months after he was convicted of masterminding the 1964 killing of the three civil rights workers, James Chaney, Andrew Goodman, and Michael Schwerner. Edgar Ray Killen was released on bail while he's appealing the conviction. Local resident Jewel Rush McDonald said, quote, we've worked so hard in trying to clear this dark cloud from over Neshoba County. And as far as I'm concerned, the judge just set us back 41 years. The interim Haitian government has released Death Squad leader Luigi Del Chamblain from prison. Chamblain is the former head of the paramilitary group FRAP. The group killed some 3,000 people in the early 90s during the 1991 coup that ousted Haitian President Jean-Bertrand Aristide for 3 years. Chamblain had been in jail since April 2004. He's been convicted several times in absentia on murder charges, but the convictions were later thrown out by the new Haitian government. In other news from Haiti, 29 members of Congress have joined with Congressmember Maxine Waters in calling for the release of Haitian priest Gerard Jean-Just. He's been in jail since July 21st. In Sri Lanka, the country's foreign minister was assassinated Friday. Up to 10,000 people are expected to attend his funeral today. The government's blaming the Tamil Tiger rebel group, but the group has denied it was behind the killing. 12 ethnic Tamils have already been detained. Here in New York, lawyers for human rights attorney Lynn Stewart have asked for a new trial, claiming she did not have an impartial jury. In February, Stewart was convicted of 5 counts of conspiracy and lying and of helping her client, the imprisoned blind sheikh Omar Abdurrahman, send messages to his followers. One juror failed to disclose that he was biased against criminal defendants. A second juror has said she was intimidated by other jurors to convict Stewart. During the deliberations, a fellow juror warned her that if she did not vote to convict, that it would be, quote, her fault if anyone died in another terrorist attack. In Washington, relatives of incarcerated men and women rallied on Saturday, calling for an overhaul of the government's prison policies. The protest comes at a time that the nation's prison population is over 2.1 million and growing at a rate of about 900 prisoners per week. This is Roberta Franklin, director of Families and Friends of People Incarcerated and organizer of Saturday's protest.
We demand that the federal parole be restored. We're also demanding for the automatic return of your right to vote when you are released from prison. We are asking for medical treatment that is fit for a human being. We're asking to stop the medical and physical abuse, put a stop to the mass incarceration due to the drug war and the mandatory minimum sentences in this country. We're asking that there be preventive programs that educate and rehabilitate rather than to continue to incarcerate people at the enormous rate that we're doing in this country.
Protest organizer Roberta Franklin. And in Chicago, a funeral is being held today for John H. Johnson, the pioneering African-American magazine publisher. He died last week at the age of 87. He was the founder of Jet and Ebony magazines and one of the most influential African-American entrepreneurs of the last half century. And those are some of the headlines. This is Democracy Now!, democracynow.org. I'm Amy Goodman. The Israeli pullout from the Gaza Strip began officially today. Gaza is currently home to 8,500 Israeli settlers and 1.4 million Palestinians. At midnight, borders into the settlements were sealed. It became illegal for Israeli civilians to remain in the Gaza Strip. Thousands of soldiers are deploying today to inform residents of the 21 Gaza settlements and four of 120 West Bank settlements that they have 2 days to move out voluntarily. After civilian relocation is complete, the Israeli military will gradually pull out. The Palestinian Authority is scheduled to govern Gaza by the end of the year, marking the first time in decades Palestinians will control the territory. The pullout is seen by some as a strategy by the Israeli state to consolidate its hold over the West Bank and East Jerusalem. Others see it as a necessary step in the roadmap to peace in Israel-Palestine. Palestinian President Mahmoud Abbas sought to convey a sense of unity and cooperation in his remarks on the withdrawal on Sunday.
We want for the settlers and the army to leave in peace and security without any undue incidents. That is what we are trying to achieve now. If you go out into the streets now, you'll discover that there is complete agreement among all of the Palestinian citizens and all of the factions. Everyone is calling for a smooth and quiet withdrawal.
The Israeli Defense Forces are prepared to reoccupy all of Gaza if they meet any resistance from Palestinian groups. Abu Youssef, a spokesperson for the Al-Aqsa Martyrs Brigade, responded to the pullout at a news conference on Sunday.
The Zionist enemy should understand that the resistance is not over, and our attacks will not have any barriers. Threatening our sites only reassures us to keep our weapons and operations.
A majority of Israelis support the withdrawal, but thousands of settlers are so far refusing to leave. The Israeli government is offering all settlers compensation and new housing outside Gaza. The settlements were originally established after the 1967 Six-Day War, when Israel claimed land outside its internationally recognized borders. Israeli historian Idit Sertal.
Settlement was a main objective in Zionist ideology and practices. And after the 1967 war, the Six-Day War, the settlements were, I could say, almost kidnapped by the Zionist religious group or movement in Israel in creating the settlements beyond the Green Line, beyond the international border.
Settlers are planning to use a variety of methods to resist relocation. This is a resident of one of the 15 southern Gush Katif settlements.
We believe that this program that Sharon made, it's not going to happen. No matter what happened, we not leave this place because it's our country. We can't give it to our enemies. So we're gonna stay here and fight. We not fight with our soldiers because they are our brothers, but we're not gonna let them take us out of here.
Several dozen Israeli soldiers have so far refused to implement the relocation of settlers. We're joined now by a number of people to discuss the implications of the Israeli withdrawal from Gaza. Joining us on the line from Gaza City is Raji Sarani, head of the Palestinian Center for Human Rights. Also from the Gaza Strip, David Matar. He's a Manhattan-born pediatrician who moved to the Gaza Strip with his wife and six children recently to resist the Israeli pullout. In our New York studio, journalist Michael Bronner. He recently spent 10 days in Gaza talking to settlers and Israeli soldiers. His report will be published on CBS News Online. Finally, joining us in the studio from Chicago, Ali Abu Nima, founder of ElectronicIntifada.org. We're going to go first to David Matar. Tell us exactly where you are.
Hello?
Hi. Can you tell us where you are right now in Gaza and what you're doing?
I'm in the Jewish village of Kfar Yam, located in the Gaza region of the Land of Israel, the biblical promised land, and which I'm sure many of your listeners know was the Jewish homeland thousands of years ago, and which we've returned to in this past century and are rebuilding.
How many people are where you are right now?
Well, along the strip of beach that includes the two communities of Shirat Hayam, Song of the Sea, and Kfar Yam, Sea Village, are about 1,000 to 1,500 people.
Are you planning
but
to...
Of course,
go ahead.
But of course, when you say that there are 8,500 settlers in the Gaza Strip and 1.5 million Palestinians, that is very misleading. I mean, you can say that there are 5 million Jews and 100 million Arabs in the Middle East, and thereby say that the Jews have no place there. There's some illegitimate invading minority. If you put a focus on one area or another, you can always say that the Jews are a minority who have no place there, which is, of course, the Arab line. I noticed that you have only myself representing the Jewish viewpoint, where you have two Arabs, one in America and one who you're interviewing from Gaza. And, of course, in your follow-up, you quoted a Israeli radical left-wing historian who accepts the Arab line delegitimizing the Jewish presence in the Land of Israel. So I want to protest at the outset that your reporting is skewed and
well, we appreciate
the underlying message is that we presence here is illegitimate.
We appreciate you joining us from Gaza. We're also joined by Michael Bronner, a journalist who went to Gaza to spend time with settlers as well as Israeli soldiers, and we're going to talk with him in a minute.
I also protest the word settler. Settler implies that we're squatters who have taken other people's land or property. That's not the case at all.
What do you call yourself?
I'm a Jew who lives in the Land of Israel. And this whole process of expulsion of Jews from communities. Hello?
Yes, we can hear you.
Expulsion of Jews from communities in the Land of Israel implies that there are places in this world where Jews are not allowed to live.
Well, David Matar, we're going to go now to Raji Sarani, Palestinian Center for Human Rights head.
I don't know if I want to debate or be involved even in an indirect conversation with Mr. Sarani.
We're not asking you to...
He's part of an Islamic terrorist state, the same kind of people who knocked down the Twin Towers and are responsible for terror against America and all over the world. And the fact that you equate or me with him or put us on the same so-called dialogue is really advocating, even only passively, Islamic terrorism, who's the enemy of...
Well, David Mattar, we're going to go to Raji Sarani right now. We will come back to you. Raji Sarani of the Palestinian Center for Human Rights. Can you talk about the significance of this day and what David Mattar had to say? Raji Sarani.
Hello.
Hi. Can you respond to what David Mattar had to say and talk about the significance of this day in these few days, the deadline for the Israeli settlers to leave? Raji Sarani.
I think for me there is nothing special. There is nothing special, nothing unique. It's not a unique day for me. It seems there is total misunderstanding for the disengagement plan. The Israeli occupation will continue in its legal and physical form. What's happening, this is unilateral disengagement plan decided by Sharon, and the occupation will remain, they will continue, they will keep controlling the borders, they will keep controlling the land, they will keep controlling the sea and the air. Gaza will be closed off. We will have no connection whatsoever with our people, relatives, the West Bank and Jerusalem. So Gaza will be disconnected from the West Bank and Jerusalem. And the only crossing with the outside world, the only connection with the outside world, Rafah crossing, will be under full Israeli control, and there will be no port or airport. It's already, in Gaza, there is 60% unemployment.
Raji Sarani, we have a very bad line. We're going to try to call you back, and we also have to break. And when we come back, we'll continue with Raji Sarani of the Palestine Human Center for Human Rights, Michael Bronner, journalist who has spent time in Gaza talking to Israeli soldiers and settlers, and Ali Abu Nima, founder of Electronic Intifada. David Mattar has just hung up the phone. The settler who just recently moved to Gaza will try to ask him to come back on the phone. This is Democracy Now!, democracynow.org. We'll be back in a minute. This is Democracy Now!, democracynow.org, the War and Peace Report. I'm Amy Goodman. We're broadcasting on over 350 stations around the country, on Pacifica and NPR and low-power FM stations, as well on public access TV, PBS stations, and both TV satellite networks, Dish Network Channel 9415 Free Speech TV, 9410 Link TV, and also on DirecTV Channel 375. We're podcasting and video and audio streaming at democracynow.org. Our headlines in Spanish, audio, and transcript, and we are closed captioned for people who are deaf and hard of hearing. We are talking about the Gaza pullout. Our guests right now are Michael Bronner, journalist who has done a piece for CBS News Online about the situation in Gaza, just recently returned. Ali Abu Nima, founder of Electronic Intifada, joins us in the Chicago studio. Raji Sarani of the Palestinian Center for Human Rights is joining us from Gaza. We're trying to get David Mattar back on the phone, the Manhattan-born pediatrician who moved to Gaza and is on the beach now resisting the ouster of the settlers from the area. Michael Bronner, talk about your experience in Gaza.
Well, I went there for about 10 days, just under 2 weeks, to see for myself. There's been so much written about what will happen, mostly today and tomorrow, and on the 17th, as people are forced to leave. They're getting their eviction notices today. So I spent a lot of time talking to settlers in the main settlement area of Gush Katif, and I also spent time out with the soldiers who are going to be ordered to remove them.
What was the soldiers? What, tell us some of what they had to say.
Well, I think for the most part, the army just really doesn't want to do this. For one, it's not what armies tend to do in terms of dealing with their own citizens. They're being asked essentially to become policemen. There are a lot of Israeli border police there as well, who are better trained to deal with Israeli civilians. The army seems there are two camps. So there are a lot of religious soldiers. The backbone of the Israeli military, to some degree, is religious settler children and just religious nationalist soldiers. And then there's been a refusenik movement for a long time for left-leaning soldiers who just don't want to serve in what they see as the occupied territories. So there's a very, very mixed feelings on the part of the army, and there's a pretty serious concern that soldiers won't want to participate either by actively refusing orders or just by passively kind of sitting it out while they're there. That's why they're bringing sort of a mass number of soldiers. They're bringing about 43,000 troops, both to remove settlers and to defend against any attacks from the Palestinian areas.
Are the soldiers armed?
The soldiers that are going to be dealing directly with the settlers will be unarmed. And if you've been in that area, you never see an Israeli soldier without his M16. So they talked to me about how strange it feels for them to be in a tense situation without their weapons, but they got a chance to do that at some of the big protest rallies that have happened in the lead up to the pullout. And then they'll be...
Are the settlers armed?
The settlers have been given, you know, when they were living there, they were given arms by the Israeli military to defend themselves. Most of them have turned their weapons in. The Israeli military has been collecting them. I'm sure that many of them still have arms. The soldiers in the protective rings are very heavily armed, and they're the ones, they're five or six brigades that are ready to reoccupy all of the Palestinian areas from Gaza City to Khan Yunis, all the Palestinian areas, if there's significant rocket or mortar fire during the pullout effort.
Hmm. Ali Abu Nima, speaking to us from Chicago, founder of Electronic Intifada, your response to the situation right now, to the beginning of the Gaza withdrawal.
Well, I really hear what Raji Surani is saying from Gaza, and it's really what most Palestinians are saying. This is a giant theater piece designed to convince the world that Israel is taking steps towards peace, that it's making enormous sacrifices. I have no doubt that there are settlers who genuinely don't wish to leave Gaza, and let's remember they've been put there by the Israeli government. The extremist ideology, the really hate-filled ideology that we heard the settler expressing earlier in the show, has been encouraged and incited for decades by the Israeli government. What's going on here really, I think, are two things that really we have to focus on. During the period that Israel has been talking about destroying 2,000 settler homes in the Gaza Strip, it has been building more than 6,400 settler homes in the occupied West Bank. Last week, for example, it issued tenders for 72 Jewish-only housing units in the settlement of Betar Alit near Bethlehem. Israel is continuing to build the apartheid wall in violation of international law throughout the occupied West Bank. It announced a month ago the wall, the route of the wall in Jerusalem, dividing 55,000 Palestinians in occupied East Jerusalem from their family, friends, places of work, schools, hospitals in the heart of occupied Jerusalem. All of this is going on while Israel is trying to get the world's attention focused on Gaza, and we've seen some very, very shady stuff going on. The settlers like Mr. Matar, Dr. Matar, who have been enjoying the land, the resources of Gaza for decades, receiving massive compensation packages of up to $500,000 per family. Just in the past few days, it was revealed that the settlers, in addition to all of the compensation they're receiving from the Israeli government, are getting an additional $14 million from private donors, including James Wolfensohn, the former World Bank head who is the U.S. envoy to Gaza, in order to pay for the hothouses they've built on stolen Palestinian land in Gaza. That meanwhile, Mr. Matar said that this is about not allowing Jews to live wherever they want. Let's recall that 80% of the population of the Gaza Strip are Palestinian refugees who have been forbidden for the past 60 years from returning to live in their homes in Jaffa, Haifa, Akka, and hundreds of other villages from which they were forcibly expelled. I'd like to say to Mr. Matar and any other person listening who sympathizes with his views, as a Palestinian, I would welcome any Jew to live in my country on equal terms, as an equal citizen, not as an armed settler, not as someone coming to rule us and take our land by force. And it's amazing to me that Dr. Matar has the freedom to move from New York, where he was no doubt living a comfortable life, and take up residence in the Gaza Strip, whereas I, like the vast majority of Palestinians, have no right even to visit our own country.
Ali Abunima, founder of Electronic Intifada. Can you talk about the settlers who are there, Michael Bronner, and your response to what Ali Abunima had to say?
A couple of responses to what he had to say. I mean, I think that in general, the population in Israel doesn't believe that this is about the peace process, this unilateral withdrawal, or that it will lead to peace anytime soon. I think some people are hoping that maybe it'll be a catalyst for something down the road, but I don't think that anyone's very optimistic that this will be an immediate catalyst for peace. But in terms of theater that he mentioned, there's, without detracting from the real difficulty that people are having leaving their homes, there's a lot of theater to this, especially the more radical settlers like Dr. Matar. They've been telling, there are thousands of journalists there, some say about 4,000 journalists, and the image of settlers being dragged from their homes or pulled from their homes is an image that they really want to have, and there's almost a sense that, you know, they're being taken to someplace far worse than down the beach where they're going, where the new settlement is being built for them, the new community.
Well, what about this? Where they're going?
Well, some of them will go to a new village that's being built between the two cities a little bit further north, Ashdod and Ashkelon. But in truth, they're not contingency plans for everyone. A lot of them will go to hotels, and there's really no coherent plan for all of them. An Israeli soldier told me that for the most part, the school year will be a wash for most of the settlers' children because the school year starts in just a couple weeks in Israel.
Michael Bronner mentioned, Ali Abunima, the journalists, the thousands of journalists that are there. On your website, you have a letter by Jonathan Cook, How to Cover Disengagement. Talk about it.
Yes, I mean, it's one of the amazing things that this theater and this show is being covered, as you mentioned, by thousands of journalists. Palestinians feel very much on the sidelines. This is a theater piece being carried out among Israelis and among Jews. And meanwhile, Palestinians are being killed, their homes are being destroyed, their land is being confiscated for settlements. The wall is continuing to destroy the lives of hundreds of thousands of Palestinians. None of this has stopped even for a minute because all the attention is on Gaza. So that letter from Jonathan Cook was to point out, he'd been asked to go to Gaza and cover it. He said, you know, I'd much rather cover what's going on in the West Bank or in Israel that's not being covered. Israel's continued unrelenting assault on the Palestinian people. And there's another aspect to the theater which I think is just as important, which is the reported Palestinian celebrations. We've seen Mahmoud Abbas, the chairman of the Palestinian Authority, heading to Gaza. An important part of this theater is the Palestinian Authority trying to claim credit for the Gaza disengagement when, in fact, the Palestinian Authority has had absolutely nothing to do with it? And the unspoken truth here, the politically incorrect truth that none of us is supposed to acknowledge, is that the only reason Israel has contemplated even this limited disengagement from Gaza is because of the unrelenting resistance to the occupation. So the Palestinian Authority is trying to present this as a result of its efforts and as a result of its efforts to crush Palestinian resistance to the Israeli occupation, whereas I think there's a much broader understanding among Palestinians and in the wider Arab world that Israel is only leaving Gaza because of the resistance, and that is the same lesson we learned in Lebanon in May 2000, that Israel never leaves occupied territory, never even contemplates it, unless the cost of holding onto it is made too high. And if we don't want resistance, if we don't want violence, then the international community has to take up its obligations to say to Israel, you must stop building the wall now, you must dismantle it in accordance with the International Court of Justice resolution, and you must immediately stop the expropriation of land, the demolition of homes, the creation of new Palestinian refugees. Every day that passes, Israel is creating new Palestinian refugees, and instead of the world standing up to stop Israel doing that, they are colluding with this theater in Gaza, giving millions of dollars to the settlers and trying to promote the fiction that this is part of some bigger peace process, when I think, as Michael Bronner acknowledged, most Israelis don't believe that. And we see the Bush administration saying in the past day or two that they hope that this will lead eventually to a revival of some kind of peace process. But clearly, there's no intention on the part of the Bush administration to move quickly to force Israel to end totally and completely the occupation in the West Bank, Gaza Strip, and East Jerusalem, or even the Gaza Strip. And a few days ago, the Financial Times reported that Israel has threatened to cancel its free trade agreement with the Palestinian Authority if the Palestinian Authority continues to insist that Israel should withdraw from the border between Gaza and Egypt. Israel is maintaining the occupation. They're simply moving it to the edges. Palestinians in Gaza will not be free. I certainly sympathize with any Palestinian who is happy to see the back of the settlers, those like Dr. Mattar, who are motivated by this extremist racist hatred. But if you're being strangled and your priority is to get a gulp of air, and that's how many Palestinians feel right now, but a gulp of air is not the same as freedom, it's not the same as life, it's not the same as an end to the occupation and an end to the apartheid system that Israel is continuing to build with the collusion of the international community and the full backing of the United States.
Ali Abu Nima of Electronic Intifada. Michael Bronner, when you were covering the situation in Gaza, you had an exclusive interview with the Israeli Brigadier General of the IDF, the Israeli Defense Forces, in charge of this, and also saw how soldiers were being trained, films they were shown, etc. Talk about that.
Well, I had a chance to sit down with Brigadier General Uzi Moskowitz, who is in charge of he's one of two commanders who are in charge of the pullout. He's in charge of the northern section and then also defense if there are attacks from Hamas or Islamic Jihad during the pullout. And it was interesting. I mean, he was very tense when he was talking about the prospect of having to reoccupy all of the Palestinian areas. It's something that the army definitely doesn't want to do in terms of international image, in terms of casualties, in terms of stress on regular Palestinians who, for the most part, have nothing to do with the attacks. And he seemed less concerned with the prospect of Israeli soldiers not being able to go through with removing citizens. That, he seemed to think, there would be no problem. They've got 43,000 troops. If any sit out, they'll just put more in and they'll be able to do this job. I actually got a chance to look at some of the video from the 1982 pullout from the Yamit settlement, which was part of the peace deal with Egypt when they pulled a settlement in the Sinai. And all the soldiers that are going to be participating in the withdrawal were able to see that as well. And one thing that's interesting is you do see soldiers that are traumatized and stressed by having to drag out Israeli settlers, and you do see settlers who are very upset at leaving their homes, and you know, some that are saying angry things to the soldiers. But you also hear in the background soldiers kind of jeering each other, and I think once the initial shock, there's been so much buildup about how stressful this will be for the soldiers and for the settlers, that once it actually starts, I think that they'll just do it, and there won't be a huge amount of trouble. Even if there's extreme violence from some of the extremist settlers, I don't think that it's anything that the military can't handle. And they're much more concerned with fighting between the IDF and the Palestinians.
Will Dr. Mattar be among those who stay? I wish we could be asking him this, but he hung up on us.
Well, he, like some of the more radical settlers, he has a very well-planned-out scenario to enact this day. I mean, he plans on, he told me, chaining himself to something. He didn't sound chained to something when we were talking to him, but, you know, I think a lot of people will passively not participate, or they'll force the soldiers to drag them out. I don't think that many will physically harm the soldiers. These are the soldiers that have been protecting the settlers that have lived there for many years, and they're really so well integrated in the population that I don't think that there'll be all that much violence against soldiers.
In our last minute, Ali Abunima, last word.
Well, it's touching the media's focus, the thousands of journalists, on the psychological trauma for the settlers and soldiers. You know, every day Palestinians are being dragged out of their homes, being shot by the army. The Israeli army is always armed when it approaches Palestinians. Their houses are demolished. Their lands are confiscated. They're cut off by the wall from friends and family. And we haven't seen this international concern over what the trauma is like for Palestinians undergoing this, particularly not by the mainstream American media. So, you know, let's focus on the whole picture here, which is that the occupation isn't going to end. This is another one of those historical turning points that we've seen so many of in the Middle East, like the Oslo Agreement or like the many turning points in Iraq. It doesn't change anything on the ground. It doesn't bring us closer to peace. And unless there is a full international confrontation with the Israeli government to force it to end the occupation completely, this simply marks the beginning of another phase in this terrible conflict that we in the United States have fueled, funded, and subsidized for so long.
Well, Ali Abunima, I want to thank you for joining us from Chicago, founder of Electronic Intifada. Michael Bronner, journalist, has just returned from Gaza covering the settlers and the Israeli military. His piece appears online at CBS News Online. David Mattar was with us, the pediatrician who had gone to Gaza with his family in the last few months to resist the Gaza pullout. And Raji Sarani of the Palestinian Center for Human Rights will try to get him back on. The line was just too bad from Gaza, but we will certainly continue to cover this over these next few days. This is Democracy Now!, democracynow.org. When we come back, a peace accord was signed earlier today between the Indonesian government and the GAM, the Achenese rebels. We'll talk about its significance with journalist and activist Alan Aaron. Stay with us. Thank you. This is Democracy Now!, democracynow.org, the War and Peace Report. I'm Amy Goodman. The Indonesian government and the Free Aceh Movement, or GAM, signed a peace agreement today in Helsinki that brings to a close nearly 30 years of armed conflict. Under the deal, GAM will disarm, be allowed to form a recognized political party. However, that party will not be allowed to seek a referendum on Aceh's independence from Indonesia. This is GAM chief negotiator Malik Mahmoud.
We come to this day at the conclusion of 6 months of talks aimed at achieving a peace agreement for the future of Aceh. But more importantly, we come to this day after almost 30 years of GAM's struggle for the liberation of the people of Aceh. We come to this day after almost 3 decades of military violence and repressions against the people of Aceh. The people of Aceh have a long and proud tradition of resisting aggressions from outsiders. And we have a long and proud tradition of justice. The struggle that we have waged for these many years has been to achieve justice for the people of Aceh. There has been no peace in Aceh because there has been no justice in Aceh. What we hope we have achieved with the signing of this peace agreement is the beginning of a process that will bring justice to the people of Aceh. Justice means ensuring that the people have a voice and that they are listened to and their wishes are followed. This means the creation of a political system that encourages freedom of speech, many opinions, and the ability to fully participate in and be represented by that process. That is, ladies and gentlemen, the only way to ensure peace in Aceh is through the implementation of a genuine democracy. Genuine democracy does not restrain the creation of political parties. It encourages the creation of political parties. Genuine democracy does not limit the range of ideas that inform those parties. It encourages the full flowering of ideas. And genuine democracy does not bow in the face of violence and injustice. It is the means of ending violence and injustice.
GAM chief negotiator Malik Mahmoud. The Indonesian government hailed the agreement as a beacon of peace in Aceh. This is Indonesian Justice Minister Hamid Aludin.
Ladies and gentlemen, with this peace accord, we are hoping that no more children become orphans. We cannot afford our women become widows. Parents will not lose their lovely children anymore. Tears and blood must be stopped. Sadness must be ended. We have to say clearly and loudly, no more and no more. And no way.
That was the Indonesian Justice Minister. As we turn now to award-winning journalist and activist Alan Nairn, who has written about the Aceh Peace Agreement and has covered Aceh and East Timor for many years. Welcome to Democracy Now!, Alan.
Thanks. Good to be with you.
It's good to have you with us. Talk about the significance of this day, of the peace accord between the GAM and the Indonesian government.
Well, it's not really peace accord, since the Indonesian military and police, which have been the main violators of peace, they retain control, they retain their weapons, their officers will not be prosecuted. Only one side disarms under this deal, the Acehnese GAM. They get farmland, they get amnesty, and they get the right to form a local political party, but in exchange they in effect take a political vow of silence. The thing that they have stood for, their reason for existence, independence for Aceh, or at least a referendum for Aceh, under which they, Acehnese get the right to hold a free vote on their political future, the new GAM political party will not be allowed to call for that under Indonesian law. So it's basically a victory for the TNI. The Indonesian military remains the sovereign in Aceh. The military will retain their troops in Aceh. The troops will still have their weapons. They will still have the right to use them. withdrawing some troops, but since Aceh remains still their country, they can bring them back later whenever they want. And even in the transition period of the next few months, when there will be about 200 foreign observers, some of the most notorious Indonesian military and police units, the intel people who run the torture centers, the Air Force, which has bombed the villages, BRIMOB units, which have done rapes and abductions at checkpoints, they are all allowed to stay as long as their troops are technically reclassified as being organic troops. And above and outside the deal, the Kopassus, the U.S.-trained special forces, the most feared group that specializes in kidnapping and torture, both local activists and military people agree that they will be staying in Aceh and continuing to do their operations undercover.
Alan, under the agreement on human rights, it says a human rights court and a truth and reconciliation commission will be established in Aceh to reveal past atrocities and bring closure to the war-torn society. And Indonesia will grant amnesty to all GAM members beginning in late August and free thousands of Acehnese jailed across the Indonesian archipelago.
Well, it's a good thing, the freeing of prisoners. It's not clear how many, though, will be freed. Some estimates are it'll just be in the hundreds. The Human Rights Court has no specified powers, same with the Truth and Reconciliation Commission. The basic fact for Aceh is that the Indonesian military and police that they will still be living under the repressive laws that govern all of Indonesia that originally derived from the Dutch colonists. And those laws prohibit free speech. They prohibit anything that can be interpreted as expressing hatred for the leaders or the government of Indonesia. And most importantly, Aceh will still be de facto occupied by the Indonesian military and police. But there is one big change under this deal, and that is it puts the armed GAM out of business, and that's a good thing. GAM should have disarmed a long time ago. This now will clarify the situation. If now people in Aceh choose to speak out in favor of referendum, they're still liable to be killed. They run the same risk as before. But now at least there's a chance that they won't be dying in vain. Because up to now, the deaths of civilians, which is the basic fact of life in Aceh, have been obscured by the two-sided combat between the GAM and the Indonesian military. That's what's gotten all the attention, obscuring the one-sided repression. But now that the GAM is out of the way, if Acehnese are still brave enough to try to stand up and speak and call for a free vote, and if they're again struck down and imprisoned, there's at least a chance now that their sacrifice will get some outside attention. And that outside attention is what's needed. That's what made it possible for Timor to win freedom. That's what the Timor case led to, the cutting of U.S. military aid to Indonesia, which helped facilitate the downfall of the previous dictator, Suharto. But in the end, I think whether this deal ends up helping or hurting the situation really depends on what's done by the U.S. and Europe and Australia and the other outside powers. The executive branches in those powers, if they use this deal as an excuse to restore military and police aid and increase military and police aid to the PNI and the Polri of Indonesia, that will strengthen those institutions. It will make matters worse. It'll be a catastrophe both for Aceh and also for Papua in the eastern part of Indonesia, where 15,000 Coast Guard troops have recently been sent in, where there's mass killing of civilians. Also the north and central islands of Indonesia, where the military and police have been fomenting Christian-Muslim grassroots violence. If this is used as an excuse to restore aid, it'll end up making matters worse. So a lot is hanging on the actions of the U.S., and it was previously grassroots activism that got the U.S. working through Congress to cut the military aid. And people have to do that again now, or this will be a disaster for Aceh and Indonesia.
Eleanor, and what role did the tsunami play in this?
Well, it was, you know, of course, one of the greatest disasters in history. It killed more than 150,000 Acehnese. It wiped out entire villages. It also killed many of the Dumb, many of their field fighters. It also brought in billions in international, pledged international aid. That affected the strategy of General Susilo, the Indonesian president. He saw that if they could get that aid continuing, flowing into Indonesia, there would be vast possibilities for corruption, for skimming of funds for the Indonesian government in Aceh and the Voice, and the military occupying Aceh. And there have already been extensive reports of this. Susilo's plan, apparently, is to use the money they can skim from the reconstruction aid to compensate the military people, the generals, for the losses they will suffer by pulling out of Aceh. Well, not by pulling out of Aceh, but by stop agreeing to ending combat in Aceh. Aceh has provided them vast corruption funds from illegal timber, from prostitution, from extortion, from offshore fishing rackets that use child labor, all sorts of things. Those will be a little less lucrative now in non-combat conditions, but in exchange, the idea apparently is they'll be able to get more foreign reconstruction aid, and most importantly, General Susilo hopes, restored military and police aid. That will then strengthen the TNI and POLRI nationally. So the tsunami, in a way, set the stage for Susilo agreeing to make that deal. And from the GOM side, I think it convinced the GOM, well, finally, they had to listen to the entreaties from civilians who were saying, look, by having an armed movement, you're only making matters worse. You're not helping the situation. Please lay down your arms. And the GOM, weakened by the tsunami, finally listened to them.
Finally, Ellen Nairn, on a wholly different subject, we just have about 45 seconds. You've extensively covered Haiti. The latest news is that Jodel Chamblain, number two man in FRAP, has been released from jail by the U.S.-backed interim Haitian government. Your response? He was in Haiti.
Well, it's outrageous. The FRAP, a paramilitary group which killed thousands of activists, from the little church, the grassroots movement in Haiti, was the FRAP was a creation of the U.S. Defense Intelligence Agency. They were formed. Manuel Constant, the man who's number one, informed the group, did so at the behest of the local U.S. Defense Intelligence Agency attaché. Constant told me that a number of years ago when U.S. intelligence people confirmed it, and Constant was carried on the payroll of the CIA. Chamblain, one of the most notorious hands-on killers in Haiti, was part of that U.S.-backed apparatus. And now he's been freed, and they call this democracy. I mean, if there were some kind of civilized legal system working in the world, he would face real justice, as would the U.S. officials from the CIA and the DIA and higher in the executive branch.
We have to leave it there, Alan. I want to thank you for being with us, Alan Nairn, journalist and activist. His website, newsc.blogspot.com. Democracy Now! Produced by Mike Berkshire from Dokadoos, John Hamilton, Anna Gara, Elizabeth Press, Jeremy Scahill, Yoruba Richin, Nell Harp, Nell Geiser, Susie Salome. I'm Amy Goodman. Thanks for joining us.